When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Crossover Sports Illustrated's NBA show, breaking down the latest news, rumors, and everything in between. Here's your host, Chris Mannix, Rohan Akhmed, and Chris Herring.
And we are back. Crossover NBA podcast. I am Chris Mannix from Miami, eagerly awaiting the arrival of his Miami Heat. We have Rohan Akhmed, and from New York, Chris Herring. Guys, we've got to get into what we saw in the game last night. I was at the TD Garden, and let me tell you, through two quarters, I was sitting there with a couple of my media brethren, and not to name names, but we were kind of scoffing at the Heat's chances of winning the series. Because
you tell me the Boston Media Mafia was all together.
This was not Boston Media Mafia. This was not Boston Media Mafia. This was National Media Mafia. And
Okay.
Look, you watch the first two quarters and you see Jason Tatum getting to the basket. You see Robert Williams having an impact on the glass and defensively. And you see Miami, which outside of Jimmy Butler and a great second quarter from Kyle Lowry, just not looking like it had the offensive firepower to keep up with the Celtics. And then the third quarter comes around and Miami puts up 46 points and blows the door off. And Heat take game one, 1-0 series lead. And now I don't know what to think about this series. Rohan, you have been riding that Miami bandwagon for some time now. Your reaction to game one.
I'm not going to lie. Even I was not expecting the Heat to win this game, particularly after that second quarter where I thought Boston in that Philly game in game seven was the first time they really looked like the Boston team I expected to see in the postseason. And in the second quarter, we were seeing shades of that. This is a team that can get a good shot offensively whenever they want, tons of switchable defenders. But I think what's made Miami so effective during this playoff run is there's no one way they've been winning games. They keep winning games, whether it's in the Milwaukee series, it was Jimmy Butler having career scoring nights and crazy shooting. In the second round, they kind of won that series in a slugfest with the Knicks, slow, low possession games, grinded out on defense. And then I think you saw in game one, but the third quarter, a lot of just individual brilliance from the Miami guys. Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo. Bam, I think, was 9 of 13 last night. Really effective against whichever big man Boston threw his way. It sounds rote, but it really came down to Miami making a ton of shots. Jimmy Butler, I think, had the most mid-range makes in a game for himself this season. I mentioned Bam, aggressive, got up to 20 points without taking a lot of field goals. The three-point shooting for them in the third quarter was really, really good. I thought Miami also did a good job defensively in the second half, getting Boston from getting to the rim. I think Boston had 40 paint points in the first half. Miami was able to clean that up in the second half. But I just think overall, I feel like Miami during the playoffs has played its best in almost every single game. And I just haven't seen that kind of consistency from Boston. And then that's what worries me about the Celtics. I think they're definitely a more talented team top to bottom than Miami. There's no question about it. But just the lapses that they have, and you think about some of the turnovers they had last night, Jason Tatum with some travels late, Rob Williams throwing the ball to Kevin Love at one point for an easy layup. At one point, are they going to take the playoffs seriously? It's kind of been my feeling about the Celtics.
No, Joe Mazzulla said after the game the Celtics won 3 out of the 4 quarters. That's not really how it works in the NBA, especially when one of those quarters you get beat 46-25. Herring, I made a comparison on Twitter that got some blowback, comparing Jimmy Butler to Kobe Bryant. And look, I'm not comparing Jimmy to Kobe in terms of style of play. I'm more saying Jimmy, like Kobe, is just looking for his spot and is going to get to his spot. And once he gets to his spot, he's just not going to be denied, whether it's making an acrobatic tough shot or getting to the free throw line. He went to the free throw line 10 times last night, made 9 of them. You know, this is, he has become, you know, a singular force in this postseason. And I look at Boston, and I'm coming into that game like, all right, well, if there's a team equipped to play against Jimmy Butler, it's probably the Celtics. They can switch everything and not be at a disadvantage on most of those switches. But whether it was Derek White, Malcolm Brogdon, Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Marcus Smart, we're talking about, for the most part, all NBA-level defenders. I mean, Smart is just a year removed from being Defensive Player of the Year. Derek White just made the second team all-defensive team. I think Jaylen Brown is probably best equipped to defend Jimmy Butler because of his combination of size and strength. And none of them had any idea what to do with Jimmy in this game one. It was a continuation of how flummoxed Jrue Holiday was throughout that Milwaukee series, and how New York, whether it was Quentin Grimes or Josh Hart or any of the wing defenders with the Knicks, they just couldn't do anything with him. This guy is having himself a postseason, and he's doing it in a way, frankly, that reminds me of how Kobe played in his day.
He's really tough to stop, and I think that what's interesting about watching him is that I don't think he leaves much on the table. I'm not saying that, but he's patient from how he does it. There's so many times where he kind of snakes around at the basket and kind of goes baseline and dribbles around, kind of the way Steve Nash has done before, you know, and has become known for. And there's so many times where I'm like, shoot it. Like, you're within 3-4 feet of the basket. And he's patient. He sometimes uses it as a way to pass the ball to Bam if he sneaks behind Robert Williams. But I think he's really intentional about getting off to good starts in these games because he doesn't play on a team that has a ton of creation, certainly without Tyler Hero. Duncan Robinson, you know, it's not the Duncan Robinson from a couple of years ago when they signed him to that big deal initially. So he realizes that if he gets it going early, even a team like the Celtics has to, or is going to feel like it's necessary to extend more defensive attention to him. And if they do that, guess what? It opens up everybody else. And that's when we, you know, to some extent, we start to see the other players open it up a little bit. Even though they fell behind in the second, and for a minute, it looks like they're going to get knocked out of the game, Kyle Lowry starts to open up a little bit. Caleb Martin, Rohan knows, I was sending text messages about him all night last night, just so impressed with his game. And that doesn't even get to the third quarter, which I'm sure we'll talk about over the course of this podcast. But there's something to be said for, given that we watched Milwaukee get knocked out, to all of our surprise. I imagine even Rohan was willing to say he didn't expect Miami to.
I picked the Bucks to sweep.
Yeah,
I
man.
The Bucks to sweep.
I mean, also, we all watched Miami struggle to even make it out of the play-in into the playoffs. So, yeah. It wasn't out of the realm of possibility that they could have just been swept in that series. Obviously, Giannis gets hurt. But after watching that, and after watching the way that it happened, we have to be open to the fact that Miami, which, by the way, last year had the highest three-point shooting percentage in the league during the regular season, that they're capable of making maybe not as many threes or as high a percentage of threes as they made in the last game, but they very well could be and probably are better than what they showed during the regular season from a shooting standpoint. And Jimmy is aware of that. By the way, Jimmy, when you talk about Kobe and the comparisons there, the other thing that Jimmy does is that, like, he's way less shy about shooting threes in the postseason than he is in the regular season. And so, I mean, he knows he can make the shot. It doesn't mean he's looking forward to taking it all the time, but he realizes one of the things that kills offenses in a time of year like this, and we saw it a little bit in the first round with Phoenix, first two rounds or so, Phoenix. We saw it with Cleveland a little bit. You have to shoot shots if you're open and it's a good look. And frankly, I never thought I'd say this. Even Tatum last night in the fourth quarter at the end of the game had a moment where he didn't look like he wanted to take one, or at least not when he was open, and he hitched and then he turned it over for the second or third straight time. So Miami, more than anything else, they know who they are. They know exactly who they are. They've been here enough times. They've had the same coach. They have a bunch of guys that know their roles to a T
even guys that are new to their roles, with Lowry being off the bench really for the first time in his career, essentially, at least since he's been the caliber player he is now, they know their roles. And I think Boston, to some extent, even though they've been here enough times to know what they should be doing, they look a little spooked at times, which is a weird thing to say after coming off a huge Game 7 victory and showing the guts that Tatum did to lead them through a Game 6 that they could have lost.
I mean, to Rohan's point, this has been a problem for the Celtics all season and certainly all postseason. Game 1, well, even go back even further. Game 5 against Atlanta. They had a chance to close out the Hawks. They have a complete meltdown and have to go down to Atlanta and win that series on the road. No Joel Embiid in Game 1 of the Philadelphia series. They let James Harden, Tyrese Maxey, and Anthony Melton get 88 points in that game and beat them. Game 5 in Boston, not competitive. They didn't play well in that game. And this was kind of a continuation of all that. The Celtics have to find a way to defend one-on-one. And this shouldn't be the challenge that it was in Game 1. They have the guys, as I mentioned, to defend Jimmy Butler. You shouldn't be sending double teams when Bam Adebayo is posting up against Rob Williams or Al Horford. You just spent, the second round defending Joel Embiid at a pretty high level. Rob Williams should not need help when Bam Adebayo is posting him up. Al Horford should not need help when Bam Adebayo was posting him up. Miami does know who it is, and it knows where it needs to be on the floor when those double teams come. And look, I don't think they shoot, 51, 52% from three in Game 2, but if they get those looks, they're going to shoot a pretty high percentage in this game. So to me, that's the biggest adjustment the Celtics have to make. Find a way to be able to defend Jimmy one-on-one. But Rohan, let me ask you this. One of the edges that Miami had coming into the series was Eric Spoelstra versus Joe Mazzulla. Eric Spoelstra has been a wizard throughout the course of these playoffs, and he once again was excellent in Game 1. In the third quarter, when Miami was putting up 46 points, Joe Mazzulla did not call a single timeout. This has been a season-long talking point when it comes to Joe Mazzulla. He has this Phil Jackson-like instinct to let his players play through it, and it's cost them some games in the regular season. You go back to Game 4 against Philadelphia when they had the ball down one with a chance to take the lead or win the game. Joe doesn't call a timeout. They wind up not getting a shot off at the end of the quarter. Look, I understand letting guys play through some stuff, but 46 points? That's a lot of points, man. That is a lot of play through right there. I just think Joe Mazzulla, he doesn't have to out-coach Eric Spoelstra, but he can't be wiped out in this particular matchup.
Yeah, and building off of that, I actually wanted to ask you about this, Chris. I rewatched the third quarter this morning, by the way, just because I was like, how did Miami do this exactly? And it was just baffling to see the Heat get bucket after bucket. And, I think there was one of the kind of the automatic TV timeouts in there, because remember they had the clip of Mazzulla throwing the clipboard on the floor. I don't know how effective that maneuver was either.
Let
necessarily.
Let me tell you this. Like, fans were calling for a timeout, after the first few minutes of the third quarter. I think that when Miami cut it quickly from 9-3, players were kind of looking over at Mazzulla, expecting him to call a timeout, but he just let them play through.
There were like three or four plays like that that you just kind of assumed that there was one coming, and then it just, Robert Williams threw the ball back in bounds trying to save it and threw it directly to Kevin Love. I was like, this is a perfect spot to call a timeout, because it felt like the momentum had just shifted so massively.
His explanation after the game, too, was weird, where
I called two timeouts in the first quarter.
Which is fine, but he also had extra timeouts at the end of the game. He called one timeout with 3:19 remaining in the fourth. And when he called it, the Celtics were kind of rolling at that moment. They had cut the Heat lead down to about
the
four.
Use it or lose it one.
And Miami and Smart kind of looked at him at one point when he called that timeout and was like, what are you doing? What are we calling a timeout there for? So look, it's not sexy, but timeout management is a real thing and has an impact on games.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask you, Chris, your opinion on something, because you talked about the defenders. First of all, you listed the defenders that Jimmy Butler was going after. Inexplicably to me, one of those guys was Peyton Pritchard. I'm not saying Peyton Pritchard has no place on the floor in the playoff game. Like, I think he's a, he would be in the rotation on most NBA teams. He just happens to be stuck behind three guards that are very, very good. But that's what made it baffling to me, that why is he even playing when you have Brogdon, White, and Smart, also in two guys in Smart and Brogdon that can guard up and spell Tatum and Brown. It made no sense to me that he was even part of the rotation. But beyond that, I thought the weirder mistake he made was, like, normally I don't think it's a big deal. Like, coaches protect their starting lineups like it's, you know, a CIA level secret and is being passed around in unmarked envelopes. You know, he said yesterday Robert Williams is going to start. I understand not wanting to change your starting lineup after having success with it towards the end of that Philly series, but I think that gave Miami an opportunity to keep Kevin Love on the floor. Mm. And it just allowed Miami to get comfortable in a way that I didn't think was a great move, because when you have Rob on the floor, it gives the Heat a place to kind of cheat off of defensively. He's obviously a lob threat, and he was good on the offensive glass and on catching lobs, but he makes things, I think, a little bit more simple for your defense. And then offensively, we saw Bam have success going one-on-one against Robert Williams. You know, Pritchard plays Grant Williams, who was a huge factor in this series last year.
That's the name I was going to bring up. Grant Williams playing instead of Peyton Pritchard.
And I want to ask about that in general, because I just don't understand what's happened to Grant Williams this season. I know he hasn't shot as well, but it feels like, I don't know if there's tension with him in Missoula. It's baffling to me the degree to which he's been left out of the rotation.
Well, if you look back, Grant Williams started the season off great. Like, he was shooting like high 30s, low 40s from three-point range through December. And then, for whatever reason, not only did the shot stop falling, but he stopped taking them quite as much. And that was the biggest source of frustration for the coaching staff. This is a coaching staff that believes there's no limit to the number of threes you should shoot. Like, they are a three-point shooting team in every possible way. And for whatever reason, you know, Grant started to hesitate and wasn't letting him fly as frequently as he did early on. Now, I don't know what the reasons were for that. Part of me has wondered at times, you know, Grant Williams is going to be a free agent after the season. He couldn't come to terms on the contract with the Celtics this past offseason. So he's also a thinking man's player, right? A very intelligent guy, vice president of the players union. Like, just, you know, I wonder if it gets in his own head sometimes. That's overthinking stuff, and that led to some problems. But there's no doubt, in this series, he's more valuable than Robert Williams. He just is. He's more versatile. He is a perimeter shooter. There are stretches, I'm sure, that you could put Grant Williams on Jimmy Butler. He's defended that type of player in the past. He's strong enough not to get muscled when Jimmy goes into the paint, which is what happened to Derek White a lot in game one. Mm-hmm. That, to me, is the biggest adjustment. I mean, I know Grant was out of the rotation in game 6 and 7 against Philadelphia. I'd start him in game 2. I'd say, Al Horford, you're the 5. Grant Williams, you're the 4. Grant, you can take your first turn on Jimmy Butler, and let's see what happens there. I think that's a big adjustment for Joe Mazzulla coming into game 2.
I mean, they put Al Horford on Jimmy to start game 1, which, it's not like Jimmy was going after him relentlessly, but it shows that they already kind of, it's just a bizarre way to start a game. Like, they'd kind of twisted themselves into a pretzel already. And you saw the Heat, as, you know, a big difference between this year's Heat team and last year's Heat team is, as much as PJ Tucker brought to the Miami defensively, Robert Williams was ignoring him in the corner all of last year whenever those guys shared the floor. It allowed Robert Williams to roam freely and kind of destruct defensively in a way that he can't against the current Heat roster. If Love is out there, if Caleb Martin's out there, and I think you saw Jimmy Butler and Bam were not afraid to attack Rob one-on-one, and Rob's giving them way more space than Grant Williams would. He doesn't have that kind of same footwork switchability that Grant Williams has. So I thought it was baffling to me, and I thought that was a bigger deal. I know people will get on Missoula for the timeouts, and it's frustrating to watch as a fan, but to me, the rotation, the Pritchard minutes, that to me was more confusing than anything Missoula did.
Yeah, the Pritchard minutes were so confusing. There was a part of me that I would say Miami was confused about it too, except Jimmy Butler, literally the first possession with Pritchard there on defense, Butler went at him, scored on him. You know, there was another possession where I think the Celtics may be wondering, like, what the hell is this?
Pritchard's out there. So they're like, okay, let me go give Pritchard a little bit of help. But then in doubling him, doubling Butler, Butler then finds a pass that results in a three. And keep in mind, these are important minutes that he's getting too. To me, it's a little bit different if it's like he comes in for spot duty for like 2 minutes. And, you know, that's a little different than like the last minute of the first quarter where it's like you're trying to finish a quarter strong and start quarter strong. And not only did they kind of not have the strongest ending to the first quarter because Pritchard was there, he then, I think, was there at, was it the beginning of the fourth quarter? And that even Lowry, you know, got a basket on him at 1.2. Just important moments in the game. I mean, it just, there were too many mistakes here. The timeout thing is baffling. Like you said, it's part of what's been his MO, but I also think that like, okay, if you want to do that in the regular season, that's fine. You messed this series up and your season's over against a team where you theoretically should be better. Okay, your players are looking at you to call timeout at that point. There's a rhythm. There's a natural rhythm to it. I know me as someone watching the game on TV, I'm like, I'm just planning on getting up to go get a glass of water or something. There's natural rhythms, certainly when a team is running off points like Miami was. Miami, this is not a high-powered offense. When they're getting 46 on you in a quarter on the road to start a series, there's something wrong. But, you know, there were too many mistakes, whether it's the timeouts, whether it's Pritchard, whether it's small things that are massive at the same time. If it's Robert Williams saving a ball that's going out of bounds and throwing it directly to Kevin Love, if it's Malcolm Brogdon misidentifying which shooter he should be paying attention to in the last seconds of a quarter and going to go cover Cody Zeller from three instead of guarding Max Strus in the corner, that costs you 3 points. There were just way too many mistakes like that. There were too many plays where Robert Williams is watching Jimmy Butler operate kind of underneath the basket and he loses sight of Bam Adebayo, who just kind of floats free and hits that little push jumper that he takes. There were too many mistakes. Miami knows coming into the series they can't make too many mistakes. There's a talent disadvantage that they're at. Boston doesn't play that way. And, you know, they make mistakes. Between Tatum and Brown, they had almost as many turnovers between the two of them as Miami did as a team. And that's not going to work, certainly when you factor in the Tatum's mistakes, three turnovers essentially in 90 seconds that he made. That's not going to cut it here, especially when Spoelstra is not going to coach his team. I'm not going to say Mazzulla's coaching his team out of a series, but Spoelstra is very, very, very unlikely to do that. It's more of an open question with Joe Mazzulla, certainly off what we just saw in game one.
Yeah, Miami has two huge advantages in this series. One is Jimmy Butler, and he dominated. The other is Joe Mazzulla, and he dominated. And that can't happen for Boston going into game two. All right, I want to talk about the Ja Morant story. I know it's been a few days since the incident, but we haven't had a chance as a group to kind of weigh in on it. And there have been some developments over the last couple of days. Over the weekend, Saturday into Sunday, Ja Morant was caught on an Instagram Live with a gun in his hand. Last time it was at a Denver nightclub. This time it was in the car of one of his close friends. As always, this clip was quickly cut and disseminated. It was everywhere within hours. The Grizzlies immediately suspended Ja Morant from all team activities, whatever that means in this moment. And the NBA announced they were going to investigate. Adam Silver was at the draft lottery, and Silver seemed pretty baffled by all of it. And even though there is an investigation ongoing, he did say he's assuming the worst, which means he's assuming that, yes, Ja Morant was once again in a car or once again somewhere with a gun in his hand. So look, I think all three of us can agree this was insane. Just a completely idiotic move by Ja Morant. So, but I think the question I want to ask, and we'll start with you, Ron, what's the league response going to be? What should it be for a situation like this? Because look, you've seen, you know, the Fox News type say, well, he wasn't breaking any laws, so there shouldn't be that significant a penalty. You had JJ Redick on TV saying, why is everyone looking to bring the wrath of God down on Ja Morant. JJ knows better. JJ knows exactly why the NBA has to come down on Ja Morant. So, Rohan, what do you think the NBA punishment should be, is going to be? How does the NBA respond to all this?
Yeah, that's obviously the big question. And before I dive into it, let us at least acknowledge that there's like a variety of factors at play here. Yes, it is frustrating to think that, you know, we can see literal like Christmas cards from politicians holding assault rifles. You know, we can agree that there is just the optics of a black player holding a gun versus a white player holding a gun. Like there is a difference there. Like, we can agree that there are a lot of factors at play to an extent. But having said all that, at the end of the day, Ja Morant is the reason he's being held to such a high standard. You know, Charles Barkley said this on TNT, and I don't like fully agree with Charles, but it's like, Charles was like, you know, you're getting paid $100 million. There's a certain things you can't do. Like, yeah, to an extent, it's like Ja Morant is held to certain standards because he's part of the NBA. He has this big shoe deal with Nike. Like, it sounds silly because, again, we see, like, you know, people all the time, like, posting photos of themselves with their guns being like, come take my guns away. And you're like, this is crazy. Like, but it's not about breaking laws or not breaking laws. It's kind of just, are you being a good representative of this league? Like, you're being expected to sell a product, sell things, and people don't want to see this. And especially after what happened in Denver, for him to just do this again is baffling. It's like you said, I was shocked. I was like, this guy can't be serious about doing this again. And even just going beyond, like, there's this commercial aspect of it, right? Like, oh, is he, you know, hurting the money? Beyond that, it's like, are you making yourself a target? Like, is this the, you know, I understand, I'm not even against the idea of NBA players owning guns. Like, players have come out and spoken about why, you know, they might feel it's necessary. I saw Paul Pierce tweeting about it. Paul Pierce, remember, was stabbed before a season. He's like, I carried a gun after that. Like, you know, these guys are occupying a different reality than us in many ways. But for me with Ja, it just is, listen, this is the standard that's expected of someone of your stature, of your importance, of your visibility. And even if he's not breaking any laws, that doesn't make this, like, this was just a baffling, I could not believe it when I saw it. I was like, is this an old video? Like, why would he even do this again? And I do think the league, I don't think it needs to be a full season, but I'm sure Adam Silver regrets the way he handled it last time because he didn't bring the hammer down. He's tried to be the compassionate commissioner. I think you have to give him 20 games or something like that. Like, but more importantly,
it's gonna be more than 20
games,
buddy.
He's getting way more than 20 games.
He can't. What can't happen is him being like, I was in Florida for 2 days, and now I'm doing a sit down with Jalen Rose. Like,
shouldn't have done
they
it.
They need
first
a
time.
Much
no, I,
more.
I think the NBA already gave Ja Morant his mulligan. You know, I wrote this in the immediate aftermath. I feel like, from the league's perspective, they showed Ja Morant compassion last time. Ja Morant talked about his anxiety issues. Ja Morant talked about his depression issues. He talked about mental health issues. And I think the NBA took all that into account when they issued the 8-game suspension, which really, you know, the money aside, was only like a 2-game suspension. The Grizzlies had sent him away for about 6 games of it, and then he was allowed to come back after 2 more. I think the NBA felt like they dangled the proverbial carrot for Ja Morant. And now I think the stick is coming for him. You know, I had people within the league talking to me about, look, if what happened didn't change Ja Morant, if losing $40 million, which Ja Morant effectively did because he didn't make one of the all-NBA teams as a result, and I think he didn't make an all-NBA team almost exclusively because of this. Like, he had the numbers to be an all-NBA player, didn't make an all-NBA team because of what happened in this incident. If he didn't learn his lesson after the distractions that he caused had something to do with Memphis losing in the first round of the playoffs, if he didn't learn from any of that, it's going to take a lot more for Ja Morant to learn a lesson. Harry, I'm with you. My guess is it's at least 30 games, and it could be as much as 40 to 45. I think we could be talking about half a season for Ja Morant. There may be an appeal, and it may be knocked down. But, you know, Adam Silver, in addition to being probably pissed off about Ja Morant less than 2 months after sitting in his office doing the exact same thing, Adam Silver also doesn't have to worry about making nice with the union right now. The collective bargaining agreement's done. That's wrapped. You know, he's got 7 years before he has to deal with any substantive issues with the union, and he might not even be commissioner in 7 years. So I think this is a moment for Adam Silver. I don't want to say an opportunity because that's the wrong word, but a moment for Adam Silver to send a message, which I can tell you is something that a lot of people, a lot of executives on other teams are urging him to do, to send a message for something like this.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think each one of us at one point or another has been critical of Adam Silver, that we, you know, to some extent he got to enjoy, if you want to call it a ride or what have you, in the wake of the Donald Sterling stuff. It's been a while since he's really come down, since the league as a whole has really come down decisively about something. We watched the Kyrie Irving episode earlier this year, which, by the way, as ugly as it was, and it was ugly, and I denounced it as such, it was not criminal, and it did not involve guns. It was not this specifically. It was not the idea of someone waving around guns. It was not someone that was in the news constantly for having threatened or threatening people or holding onto a gun or anything like that. This is ugly in a different sort of way. It's also someone that is like ascending at the time, who just took Kyrie's shoe deal, essentially. There's a lot of, so that to me, the Kyrie stuff was ugly in a certain way. The league did not come down on him about that until the Nets had an opportunity to handle it first. It seems like the league prefers to let teams handle this stuff first, even with Ja Morant's first episode. The fact that this is not even, is it even 2 months after Ja was punished the first time? Less than 2 months after.
Crazy.
I thought it was a bad look optically that the day that Ja Morant met with Adam Silver, he had a sit-down scheduled with Jalen Rose. I remember thinking, like, this can't be real. Like, that Jalen Rose, that he's tweeting out images and video from his sit-down with Ja Morant, when I think it was earlier that week that we'd even heard that he was in counseling. And even for that, we don't even know what it was for. It was not a long stay. A lot of people at the time were quietly saying, like, if he had real issues, there's no possibility that they could have been resolved within the short amount of time he was there dealing with them. And I wrote in my column as compassionately as I could, essentially shame on Ja Morant's folks, if not Ja himself, for trying to frame this as solely a mental health thing the second you get in trouble, when there have been four or five other things that you've essentially skated on. Whether they happened or not, there was enough smoke there to potentially be fire. So, you know, don't give other people that are also dealing or are dealing with mental health issues a bad rap from the standpoint that, like, only when it involves guns, like, oh, you know, like, I've got to get my mental health straight. That's not fair to those people. It particularly looks bad now that even after using that, even after serving your suspension, even after missing out, as you said, I put him on my All-NBA team because I set a threshold of 60 games that I felt like guys needed to play to make them eligible for the team that I wanted to put together. I think he played 61 or 62. He barely made it. If he played 69 or 67 or 68 with his numbers on the second seed in the West, he's a lock. He would have made it. But what are we even talking about here? That, not to mention that the person that he was with in this video is someone that had been banned from games by the league. So it's just such a bad look all the way around. I think the league is absolutely going to drop the hammer here to send a message, in part because we've all been getting on the league about not having sent messages with some of this other stuff. I would not be surprised if he got 50 games. I think he'll get at least 40. I think it's sad. I think, for once, I agree with the old heads on this. Like, if you want to do all that stuff, that's fine. It won't be in the NBA. And it's sad. I really hope he straightens it out. I thought one of the best suggestions Mark Spears had, that I saw, was something Mark Spears said about the idea of Carmelo had a lot of early
career missteps. A DUI, yep. A weed charge. He had been in the stop snitching video. He had gotten a fight and sucker punched someone at Madison Square Garden. And that was when David Stern dropped the proverbial hammer on him, because this was in the wake of Malice at the Palace. Everybody else involved in it got 5 or 6 games. Carmelo got 15. And he was like, I'm absolutely making an example of you because you mean more to the league than these other guys do. And you've had multiple missteps here. So I'm making an example of you till you figure it out, basically. And I would be surprised if Adam Silver doesn't do that. Not to be lighthearted, punny about it. John Morant has given him the ammunition to do that here. And I don't even understand people that are like, oh, like, yes, the tone of guns in this country and everything is silly and ridiculous and far beyond what it should be. But the morality clause in the NBA existed far earlier than where we're at now with some of this gun stuff. You're not going to force Nike and Powerade and the NBA at large to have to deal with this guy if they don't feel like he can refrain from putting guns up on an IG Live or his friends doing it. It just looks like a total lack of care.
It's not even
with regards to any of this stuff.
Right. It's not even like John Morant can't own a gun. It's like, why do you have to wave him around on Instagram, man? Like what is going on?
John Morant needs new friends. That's one of the variables. But John Morant's friends
might need new friends.
Because that was what I agreed. And this is where I'm saying, like, I've never felt like as much of an old head as I have in the last week with regards to how this punishment should be handled. Kenny Smith said that on Inside the NBA last night, where he was like, John Morant is the friend that you need to be concerned about, because at a certain point, I'm sure people told Ja to stop hanging out with this one dude. Ja clearly doesn't want to. And also, if that wasn't Ja's Instagram Live, it was the friends. So it's like, well, but why are you... If you said that you also took ownership of the fact that part of the reason your season came up short was because you were a distraction. Mm-hmm. This was a couple weeks ago, not even months ago. They got knocked out in the first round, albeit by a team that, like, very easily could still go to the finals. Maybe not very easily, because Jokic is good. But, I just don't... There's a total disconnect here, and it's a little premature to say this, but for the first time, really, is Memphis is forcing this guy away from the team for a while. You start to wonder, is he actually the future of our franchise? Like, if all this stuff still doesn't set in for him, the money, the fact that we were just knocked out, the fact that this happened 2 months ago and that you sat down face-to-face with the commissioner, the fact that you've invoked mental health with regards to it, the fact that there have been all these other things that he potentially could have gotten in real trouble for that frankly lucked out, that some of it wasn't investigated carefully, because people aren't really looking to make an example of someone that is that big a name in the community, quite frankly. He has been fortunate to not have gotten any more punishment than what he's had. So I don't wish anything on him. I wish that this would get through to him so that it's not a recurring issue anymore, but I am now at a point where I'm worried for him, because I don't know what the wake-up call is. The scariest thing I've heard over the last few days is just the idea that people that really are about that life look at this and like, oh, so this is what you want life to be like, but you don't know it. And I think that actually does agitate a crowd of people that do know what that life is. And
You're talking about the clip, I think, from Brick Baby, the rapper part of the that was making the rounds on social media, who is, is or was one of the Crips back in the day. And he was out there saying, what are you doing, Ja? You can't be throwing up that Crip sign, during games. And if you are, you better pay us. You got to pay the Crips to do that. Like, I mean, Ja strikes me as a guy, who... I don't know everything about his background, but kind of where he's from in South Carolina. He grew up with his parents. He went to college. Like, he strikes me as a guy that wants to be about a life that he's not. And, there's a danger of that. The legality of what Ja Morant did in that car is not an issue here. Like, take one of us. Like, if it was one of us in a car flashing a gun, we'd probably get fired, from our jobs. Like, not because it was illegal, but because we work for private companies that have the right to do whatever they want if they feel like we are tarnishing their image. And the NBA is courting and has deals with, you know, family-friendly products, whether it's, you know, soda, Powerade, waters, like everything. They got their hands in all kinds of pies that drive revenue for the NBA. So, you know, there's a reason the league is probably going to come down pretty hard on John Morant, because they can't have this become a thing with John Morant or anybody else that thinks it's acceptable to do stuff like this. I mean, I did think that, you know, having gang members weigh in and criticize you was wild. That was a wild new wrinkle.
I can't remember that one at all. Yeah.
I'd never seen that before. Mm-hmm. I mean, if this is not a wake-up call for John Morant, I don't know what it is. But bottom line, I'm going to guess between 40 and 50 games for John Morant next season. And if it ever happens again, multi-year suspension we could be talking about. I mean, I think the NBA is going to come down pretty hard this time. I think the union's probably going to fight them on it, you know, whatever they decide to do. But I think this will be Ja Morant's last chance.
Have you ever, have you, I mean, Mannix, you're in LA and have had to profile people of this stature before, probably in settings where maybe it wouldn't be a crazy thing. There are a lot of celebrities that when you're in their space, hanging out with them, that they will, when you're at an event at their place, they will literally collect your phone. Not that I'm like encouraging Ja to be waving around guns at any point, but certainly not when he's like on a video camera or on a phone. Like at a certain point,
right? It's so self-inflicted.
It's just you need to, like, Ja maybe doesn't need to have a phone or on him when he's like doing anything, and maybe the circle of people that he's gonna have need to not have phones with them when they're like, because it's just. It's self-inflicted in a way. And that doesn't mean that stuff that he does won't be caught another way, that we won't see images from a bar or a club or something, surveillance footage that someone uses, which that was a funny image. But I'm at a total loss, and it's just, it seems over such stupid stuff. You know, the one last thing I'll cite that Barkley said, and tying it back to what I said about Carmelo and the fact that Mark Spears wrote a piece about Carmelo putting a team of advisors around him after he had early career missteps with stuff as it related to the law and just as far as the NBA's morality stuff and whatever else. It's fine to have a gun. It's fine to have someone in your party, in your circle, that has a gun. Let that be your security guy. Ja's probably at a place where he needs one. When you have people who are affiliated weighing in on stuff as it relates to you, you probably should have one. But Ja, also just being a big-name celebrity as it relates to the NBA, should have one. But as Barkley was saying yesterday, and I agree with him, you will never know I have it. You will never know my security guard has it because you're not waving it around, because that's not what it's for. And irrespective of the conversation around Ja and the country and where our country is at with guns, it's an issue. It's a problem. But the people that make the argument of like, oh, he should be able to do what he wants because of gun culture in this country, they're not worth hundreds of millions of dollars. They're not a corporate face for the league. And I get it that at 23 in a jersey, in a uniform, that people aren't thinking about it corporately, but watch press conferences when you see all those companies that are behind them. Hell, Chris, you're sitting in front of a sports, like you said, we're part of a brand. You don't get that luxury, if you want to call it that. It doesn't feel like luxury to me, by the way, of like waving guns around, but you don't get that luxury. You don't get that pass when you are representing the Grizzlies, the NBA, Powerade, Nike. You know,
the NBA finals are sponsored by YouTube TV. Like there are corporate sponsorships everywhere. And yeah. To your point, if you're Ja Morant and you want to act like that, you have every right to do it. Like, as a resident of this country, you can do it. You just can't do it and expect your employer, the NBA, to tolerate it and to pay you the kind of money that it's been paying you. All right, I want to finish with what we saw this week in Philadelphia. The Sixers go out in the second round. The first casualty is Doc Rivers, fired after 3 seasons on the job. You know, look, fair, maybe not, but surprising, not really, because, look, this Sixers team came in with the most pressure on it of any team in the playoffs. They had to at least advance past the second round. They didn't do it. They blew a 3-2 series lead. Coach is always the first to fall. But Rohan, I interpreted this as a overture to James Harden, because I was in that Sixers locker room after game seven, and I was standing there when a reporter asked James Harden what he thought, what his relationship was like with Doc Rivers, and does he want him back? And James Harden said, it's okay, meaning his relationship with Doc is okay. You knew then and there that it was one or the other, and the Sixers moved quickly to at least signal that they were going to choose James Harden. So I guess the question for you is, were you surprised by the decision to fire Doc Rivers? And, you know, what does this mean for the future of James Harden, who has a very complicated offseason ahead of him?
Definitely not surprised. As you mentioned, the coach is kind of the low-hanging fruit. I actually thought Doc did a really good job with this team throughout this season. He really leaned into that Harden and Embiid pick and roll this year in a way that I think maybe fans were upset that he did not last year. The fact that they pushed Boston to seven, I don't think anyone expected that, frankly. I don't think anyone expected Philly to be up 3-2 and have a chance to end this series at home the way they did. And do I hold Doc responsible for what happened in that fourth quarter? No, I do not. Do I hold him responsible for Embiid and Harden both laying massive eggs in game seven with, you know, all-time choke jobs and pathetic performances and all the turnovers? No, I don't hold Doc responsible. I think he was actually a good coach for this team. What's baffling to me, Chris, you also heard Daryl Morey say in his press conference about the firing that Joel Embiid was shocked to receive this news. Now, is Daryl maybe playing that up for the media a little bit?
No, I don't think he was. Everything I had heard from people around Joel was he was not pleased. And Joel gave a resounding endorsement.
Yes.
Doc.
Embiid gave a very, you know, he thought he'd done a fantastic job. Why is Daryl Morey, catering to James Harden as opposed to Joel Embiid? That's what I don't understand. I know Morey came in, this is going to sound more sensational than it is. Like, Embiid's not Morey's guy, right? Like, he didn't draft him. But even Daryl Morey is smart enough to know who the single most important aspect of this franchise is, and that's Joel Embiid. Why are you catering to James Harden? There's rumors already that they might bring in Mike D'Antoni. I'm not saying that they should not have gotten a different coach. I could see why they might need someone. I just think that they're going about it completely backwards, catering to Harden here. Why do you want James? Are you sure you want James Harden back? Like, you can't just let him walk for salary reasons. But I think their best bet is to look for a sign and trade for Harden or something this summer. Are you going to bring him back on a max and get him the coach he wants after that playoff performance? Outside of the two 40-point games he had 67 in the other five combined. I'm just blown away that Philly seems to want to get back into bed with Harden after the way the playoffs shaked out. I would be nervous if I were a Sixers fan, the degree to which they seem to think Harden is an important part of this team moving forward.
I mean, all I've heard the last couple of days from people I respect on television is that it would be a disaster if James Harden walked away from Philadelphia. I don't really see it that way. If James Harden walks away, going into next season, yeah, they'll be without a terrific all-star caliber guard. But I think with more opportunity, Tyrese Maxey will play better. I think he has another level to get to if has the ball in his hands a lot more. You would have Tobias Harris's contract, which has 1 year remaining at a big number. You could trade that for another piece to the puzzle. And you still have Joel Embiid, who is going to be 30 next year in his prime, coming off an MVP season. So I don't think it would be catastrophic. What I do think will be catastrophic for Philadelphia, and I've said this repeatedly, is giving James Harden a max contract. Mm-hmm. And it feels like that is going to be what it takes. You had Chris Haynes reporting that Harden is going to opt out of this contract. Not a huge surprise there. Owed $35 million. He's going to be looking for between $40 and $50 million per year on a four-year deal. And the Sixers, as has been noted elsewhere, do not have the advantage of being able to offer him that fifth year. So it's open season right now for for James Harden with every team with cap space in the NBA. And these rumors about Houston, even though I think they're wild, like I think it would be absolutely bonkers if the Houston Rockets go down and sign James Harden. If they give James Harden 4 years and $200 million, Adam Silver should seize control of the franchise and operate it, because it would be one of the more insane moves I have ever seen a front office make. This is not about James Harden, the player. It's about where Houston is right now with its organization, yeah, in the infancy of a rebuild where you have Jalen Green, you've got Jabari Smith, you've got Alperen Sengun, you're going to get another top draft pick with the fourth overall pick. They are not in the kind of position where you need to bring James Harden in. If we're being quite blunt, James Harden is not exactly the veteran role model I think I would want some of these guys around. There's a reason James Harden wants to come back to Houston and be part of that organization. Some of the reporting around James Harden was that he was looking for, you know, a chance to kind of play his way and, you know, be part of a competitive situation. Well, what he wants seemingly is a return to the yesteryear days when he was the MVP. And
I thought you were about to say a return to the club. Sorry.
I mean, well, yeah.
I thought you were going there.
No, I mean, like, look, he likes Houston.
Yeah.
He likes the scene down there. Yeah. So, I mean, there's no disputing that. But if you're the Rockets, you're nuts. That is absolutely insane. But that seems to be in the water supply. That seems to be a possibility for James Harden. And if Philly thinks that's a possibility, they're going to have to grossly overpay to keep him. And if they give James Harden a contract at 4 years and close to $40 million or more per season, that instantly becomes the most untradeable contract in the NBA. It does, because Harden's going to be 34 at the start of next season. This will take him up to age 38. He's already shown signs of decline. Nobody's taking that contract on. What I think re-signing James Harden to that type of deal does is I think it puts a ceiling on Philadelphia, and that ceiling is not championship. It's not. I think if you don't re-sign him, maybe in the short term, at least on paper, you are a worse team, but I think you're underestimating how much improved Tyrese Maxey will be with a bigger role. And I do think there's some maneuvering to be done with some of the flexibility that you've created with Tobias Harris's contract that is still out there. With whatever draft assets you have left to make deals, you can bring in a piece that works. Look, Herring, Milwaukee showed that you don't need multiple superstars to win a championship.
Yeah.
You just need one alpha, one big-time top five player, and the right pieces around him. And Joel Embiid is that alpha, and is going to be that alpha if he's healthy for two or three more years. That should be the priority in Philadelphia. Re-signing Harden at a big number, that just seems crazy to me.
Can I say this? And I really hadn't thought about it till just now. I think if they re-sign Harden at a big number for more than, I would say, 2 years, which if you get him back, I imagine he would not sign it unless it's for more than that. That will be the capstone and the end piece of the process, if we're not already there. Because I can't think of a team, and I don't think I was discussing it with either of you all. I was talking to my friends about it. I can't think of a team, a high-level team that's in the conversation basically every year for championships, that has shot itself in the foot more than Philly. There have been so many high-level mistakes. They just got beat by one of them in the playoffs from the standpoint of, okay, and I understand, and it's not to say that some of these weren't understandable mistakes, by the way. Markelle Fultz, the Jason Tatum thing, there's that. There's the fact that they took Okafor in a draft that also had Karl-Anthony Towns. They didn't quite get the number one pick, but Porzingis turned out to be really, really good. So there's that aspect. There is someone else that's still in the playoffs that they're watching kick ass, and Jimmy Butler, and the fact that, you know, depending on
they couldn't trade James Harden for Mikal Bridges straight up today. Brooklyn, like,
right.
They could have drafted Mikal Bridges.
They could have kept to include like three firsts. Yeah.
But they could have. They could have kept him, you know. And that was someone that, like, I'll never forget that one specifically, because that,
Like, I've always thought that it's very awkward that we've got the Mannixes and the Wojes and the Shams of the world that get information and can report it before it's actually live on television on draft night.
That ain't me. That giving me too much credit on that one. That
I mean, I get one or two
draft picks.
You'll be knowing stuff before it happens, even if you don't necessarily report it or you're still waiting to hear more. Like, I working with you now for long enough, I know that you know certain things before they happen or that they might happen. The Mikal Bridges thing was so awkward, though, because his mom worked for the organization. They drafted him. ESPN had it teed up. They already had him on camera talking to, I guess it wasn't Malika, maybe at the time it was Rachel Nichols or whoever it was, but talking to him on camera about what it was going to be like to be able to stay home, play for an organization that you have a tie to. And meanwhile, we're back at the ranch. We're all on Twitter like, he's going to Phoenix. And so the fact that they shipped him out, there's just been so many errors, high-level errors. James Harden signing a long-term deal. And I say this as someone that was blown away by the fact that he had two 40-point games in this last series. Like, he still had – there's still flickers and moments. And by the way, he was great during the regular season when he was healthy. Led the league in assists, still was able to score, still was able to get downhill. I think the biggest shift that we've seen with him is that he slowed down a tick and that he does not draw fouls at the same rate. He's a better shooter than what he was several years ago. But that's not the problem here. He's also not a great defender. We've known that for a while, even if it was overstated a little bit. He's not
a bad defender.
He's not going to age well at this point. Like, even if he's really important to your team now, I always think that when the moment comes when you're essentially over the cap and you don't have a replacement for someone because you can't go out and get somebody else for real money because of where you're at cap-wise, this is when teams make bad mistakes. And they made it the last time when Butler was there figuring out that situation and how much was Ben Simmons going to worry about. I didn't even mention Ben Simmons and all the mistakes they've made. But I mean, this would take the cake on some level, and I think it would effectively close their window. You have to trust that Maxey is good enough. He's shown in moments where Harden isn't there that he's ready to take that spot. Doesn't mean they're going to win a championship by letting Harden go, but you have to ask, like, is the upside of letting Harden walk long-term better than locking yourself into something that you can't trade? And I think the answer might very well be yes on that.
They have made mistake after mistake, really, for the last 5 years, going back to 2019 when they wouldn't extend that five-year contract to Jimmy Butler. I mean, imagine where they'd be right now. I mean, is there any better pairing or pairing that you'd want more than Jimmy Butler and Joel Embiid? Like, two ultra competitive guys.
Embiid respects the hell out of him, too.
Incredibly so. Incredibly so. So I just think that was the big mistake. I understand the logic behind trading Simmons for Harden, and it's not like Simmons has done anything since then. But even though you gave up real capital to go and get him, you can't. Look, if you get him at 3 years, 90, great. Bring him back. Absolutely. If it costs you 4 years, anywhere from 160 to 200, hell no. Hard pass. That is a franchise detonating deal. It just is.
There's only a couple teams that it even makes sense for him to go to on bigger money than what you just talked about.
Any team that it makes any sense. Who does it like? I mean, Houston, it makes no sense. And I jump up and down on Houston a lot. I think they've made some gaffes over the last couple of years. I think scapegoating Steven Silas was one of them. But
the one team that makes sense.
Okay.
And it's because their owner can spend however much money he wants. That's the Clippers. It's the only team that makes sense. They have the contracts. They can get away with paying him for a couple, even up to 3 years. They're opening a new arena. You know, their main guys are always hurt. That's the only team that makes remote sense to me. And even then, it's not like I think it makes them the favorites. Mm-hmm. But yes, I just can't get over that they're going to find a coach for James Harden. Like, what are they like? Daryl Morey's obsession with this guy, it could really come back to hurt them.
If it's Mike D'Antoni, I give up.
Bro, it's D'Antoni, bro. Come on.
Is Joel Embiid getting any touches in that kind of system? Like, how does that work? No, I know Mike D'Antoni had Amari Stoudemire, but this is a different kind of player altogether.
They weren't letting Amari post up 15 times a game.
All right. Well, Heat Celtics, back in action on Friday night. On Thursday, we get Lakers and Nuggets. We'll be back on Monday to break down all of it here on the podcast. In the meantime, subscribe, rate, and review everywhere you get your podcasts.